You know, state's transportation officials are preparing to send out letters to motorists come October, which is just next week. It's the latest phase of a pilot project to determine if our current system of funding our highways should hinge on the current fuel and vehicle weight tax and registration fees. As more cars and trucks become fuel efficient, that source of income will drop. The DOT has unsuccessfully tried to hike those fees, but state lawmakers have been reluctant to do that. The federal government has provided $4 million to Hawaii to determine whether the road usage program makes sense here on the islands. We talked to DOT spokesman Tim Sakahara as it tries to get the word out about what drivers need to know.
Starting next month, after someone gets a safety check, a few weeks later they should receive a driving report in the mail. And what that driving report will tell people is what they paid in the fuel tax since their last safety check, and then what they might have paid or estimated paid under the road usage charge, the HIRUC, that the Department of Transportation is studying right now. And so it'll give them an idea of a comparison of what they did pay under the fuel tax and what they might have paid under the road usage charge.
Okay, you use the term HIRUC. Explain.
HIRUC is just the acronym. It's the Hawaii Road Usage Charge. What the Department of Transportation is doing right now is trying to find an alternative solution that's a fair and equitable way to collect revenue based on the miles people drive instead of the gas that they burn. Now, there's been a misperception or assumption, I should say, from a lot of people that the low-income or the rural drivers would actually be hurt or pay more under the road usage charge. And actually, what the studies and research has already shown is that the low-income and rural drivers actually drive older, less fuel-efficient cars. So that actually, in many cases, they would actually pay less under a road usage charge than they pay with the fuel tax. One of the ways to look at it is about 20 miles per gallon. That's kind of the key number here. If someone's vehicle that they're driving right now gets 20 miles per gallon, they're probably going to break even, or it's going to be very close to similar based on the fuel tax or the road usage charge. If their car gets less than 20 miles per gallon, they're actually probably going to save money under the road usage charge versus the fuel tax. And of course, if someone gets better gas mileage than 20 miles per gallon, then they might end up paying more.
So you folks just completed a statewide outreach. This is a pilot project. We're trying to collect good data on whether it might be worthwhile to switch over from the current system we have to this road usage plan.
Yeah, and the reason being is that the fuel tax revenue is the largest source of revenue for the Highways Division right now, but it's dwindling, and it's only going to continue to decrease as time goes on as more vehicles get fuel efficient. And we should point out that we fully support people going to electric vehicles or hybrids and people getting better gas mileage. It's actually a great thing. It's a positive thing. Department of Transportation wants to help meet those goals to get more sustainable fuel sources. But in saying that, the roads still need to be maintained. The guardrails still need to be fixed. The streetlights still need to be operable. The roads need to be filled with the potholes, right? So the funding still needs to be there no matter what kind of car is driven. And we're trying to solve a problem now before it becomes a crisis later on down the road.
And other states and cities are looking at this as well.
Yeah, in fact, there's about 15 states across the country that are also doing this study and demonstration to try to determine if the road usage charge would be, in fact, a better and more fair and equitable way to collect revenue to pay for the Highways Division instead of the fuel tax. That's also another important point. If the road usage charge was implemented, it would replace the fuel tax. So in that case, the price of gas would go down instantly overnight, 16 cents, and that state fuel tax would be eliminated. It would not be in addition to. It wouldn't be a new tax in addition. It would be a replacement of the fuel tax.
Okay, so statewide, motorists need to know that they will be getting something in the mail. Tell us about that.
Yes, so after someone gets a safety check on their vehicle, a few weeks later, they're going to receive a letter in the mail. It'll be addressed to the registered owner of the vehicle. And what it'll tell them is this is how much that person paid over the last year under the fuel tax. And next to it, there'll be another number in the column next to it that'll tell them the estimated price they would pay under the road usage charge. And so they could kind of compare the two figures and see, okay, well, maybe I'm going to pay a little bit more, maybe I'll pay a little bit less, depending on how many miles they drive and what kind of vehicle fuel efficiency they have on their car. Certainly, if someone drives an electric vehicle right now, their number for the fuel tax is going to be zero because they've been paying $0 because obviously they don't have to buy any gas. So under the road usage charge, they would now have a number that they would pay based on the miles that they drive.
Okay, and as part of this report, there's going to be a survey, so you need some public input on this.
Yes, absolutely. So when people receive this driving report in the mail, we please ask, do not dismiss it. Do not treat it as junk mail. It's actually very important. We want people to go to hiruck.org, that's HIRUC.org, and then fill out a very quick survey. Reason why that's important is there's a lot of different and varying opinions on this topic. It's a very debatable topic, and we want to hear from everybody, all voices, what they feel about it, how they think it would work, about any of the collection methods that are happening. So we want to hear all, the good, the bad, and the ugly, of what people have to say about this. But the only way we're going to get that information is if people participate in this survey, which should only take them a few minutes.
Now, you're also looking for some early adopters, right? Some 2,000 volunteers to take part in this?
We are. After the driving report phase, start going out, early next year, we're going to be seeking 2,000 volunteers. And what we want those volunteers to do is kind of a demonstration itself. They're going to give us help be our volunteer to kind of collect the mileage they drive and then give us feedback and additional feedback, because everything that we're doing is going to be based on the opinions and input that we receive from the public. So that those volunteers are going to be a very big part of it as well.
So this pilot, how long does it go, and what kind of federal help, federal funds have we gotten to help launch it?
The demonstration itself is about 3 years, and we're about 1 year into that. The first phase that we did was all the community meetings on all islands all across the state, and all the outreach, talking to neighborhood boards and rotary clubs and community groups and everything like that. And now we're moving into the next phase, which is that driving report. Fortunately, Hawaii is very grateful. We received the largest federal grant of any state in the country. We received almost $4 million to be able to study the road usage charge. So this demonstration is actually being funded by a federal grant, which, again, we're very, very appreciative for. It should also be noted, though, that this process, as we've seen with other states, it's not going to happen overnight. It's about a 10-year process. And then at the end of it, even, it's not going to be the Department of Transportation that's making the yes or no decision on this. It's just compiling all the findings and research, maybe making a recommendation, and then sending it up to the state capitol for the lawmakers to decide and debate, see what worked, what didn't, if they want to implement it, if not. And then it'll go to them for a vote, and then ultimately to the governor to either sign or veto.
Okay, so we're still early on in the process. Public input, though, is key. So, whether you drive a gas guzzler or an electric car, you're really looking to get kind of a broad stroke across the state.
That's exactly right. And even though we're early in the process, it's very important to get that feedback early in the process now. We'd much rather get feedback from people now than 10 years from now, because it will help shape the demonstration and the study itself and the findings. And yes, whether people drive an old gas guzzler that's 25 years old or a brand new electric vehicle, right, we want to hear from everybody and all their thoughts on this process.
That was Tim Sakahara, spokesman for the State Department of Transportation, talking about this latest phase of the Hawaii Road Usage Charge Demonstration Pilot Project that's about to roll out here in October.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kadena & Company, investment advisors celebrating 40 years, committed to its fiduciary responsibility in working to preserve and grow client wealth. CADINHA.com.
You know, the latest immigration battle in our nation's capital is over what's been called the public charge rule. It would bar immigrants from becoming citizens if they've ever enrolled in government benefits like a Medicaid or food stamps. U.S. Senator Mazie Hirono just last week co-introduced legislation called the Protect American Values Act, which would block the rule. The Congresswoman has been outspoken and angry in the era of the Trump administration, but she also wanted to let us know she reaches across the aisle when she can. Here's an excerpt of a recent call-in show that we aired on the conversation. In our interview, she explains her opposition to the public charge rule.
These are not normal times, and we have a president who is very divisive. The kind of policies that he implements, challenging the Affordable Care Act and all the anti-immigrant things that he continues to impose, including, by the way, public charge that's going to impact a lot of people in Hawaii, all those things. So this is a time for me and everyone else, as far as I'm concerned, to raise our voices and let people know what harm is happening in our country.
You know, we just heard with someone talking about, you know, it's time to choose to support what you believe in, you know, taking a stand. And that's what's happened, I think, with this administration. It challenges you, right? What do you believe in?
That's right. And so there's a lot more talk about the values that our country has. And people are asking ourselves, what do we stand for? We have a president who is very much against immigrants coming here from minority immigrants. And just in so many ways, he attacks the environment, all of these things. And what's really great for me to hear is that I hear from people who say their 70, 80-year-old mothers in particular are becoming very engaged and enraged, actually, with what's going on. So they watch the news and all of that, and they are having their voices heard. And the other, to me, encouraging part is all the young people who are coming forward. We had DACA. You know, 800,000 DACA participants. No, they cannot vote, but I would want them to be on a path to citizenship. And they were in the Capitol in Washington, D.C., to advocate for the continuation of DACA by the thousands. These are going to be engaged people. And then, of course, all the young people who came forward for gun safety laws, common sense gun safety laws. You even had scientists marching in Washington, D.C. That's never happened before. You have teachers going on strike all across the country because they really believe in quality public education. We have an education secretary who doesn't believe in public schools. That's Betsy DeVos.
So it's easy for you to stand up because you see all these things happening.
I think it's important. It's important to raise our voices. And so I take the opportunity. I'm glad that I have the opportunity to point out and to very much disagree with the president's priorities and policies that harm our families and our communities.
You mentioned the public charge issue. Explain to our listeners what we're dealing with here.
The public charge rule is a new rule that is going to be implemented by this administration. And what the effect of this will be that it will be much harder for people to come to our country because they will be asked certain questions such as, you know, whether we think that these people are going to end up accessing public services like Medicaid or housing, et cetera, without realizing that the people who come to our country legally, they cannot access public services for 5 years. It's not as though everybody comes into our country and get on welfare. That's not what's happening, what happens at all. So this public charge rule will make it a lot harder for people to come into our country, and it will also make it a lot harder for people who are already in our country to get their green cards or to change their status to become citizens, because they will be asked questions such as, have you ever used, have you ever accessed Medicaid, or have you ever had housing help? And so what's happening is, and I talk with folks on Maui, the Maui Economic Opportunity people, and they have thousands of clients. They said about 85% of their clients on Maui will be impacted negatively by this rule. People are very afraid to access the services that they paid for through their taxes.
And I believe here in Hawaii, it's like 1 in 5 are immigrants?
1 in 5 are immigrants, and 1 in 3 are either immigrants or children of immigrants. So the children of the immigrants are very afraid that their parents at this point may be deported because they've accessed public services.
So what do you plan to do about it?
I do have a bill that I'll be introducing when I return to the Senate that will prevent the use of any resources to implement the public charge rule.
And so what kind of support do you think you're going to get?
I'm sure I'll get the support of the Democrats, but it is all the Republicans who continue to support this president. Hardly any of them raise any concerns about what the president is doing. And so we will continue to push forward because I think that at a time like this, the Democrats need to continue to be the loyal opposition. That is not to say, Catherine, that I don't work with the Republicans on the Senate. I have a number of bills that have been enacted into law that have been co-sponsored by Republicans. So there are a number of issues that I can work with my Republican colleagues on. But on some of the biggest issues that impact all of us, such as health care, such as immigration, it's very divisive, and the Republicans stick with the president. You know, one of the harmful things I have to say, remember when we had the government shutdown? And we had a month of people working for the federal government who didn't get paid two paychecks. Mitch McConnell could have brought a bill to the floor of the Senate to end the government shutdown legislatively. Yes, it would have taken the president to sign it into law, but we are a separate branch of government. The House had already passed a bill that would keep government open. And Mitch McConnell refused to bring that House-passed bill to the Senate floor, which it would have passed. He refused to do it because he kept saying, well, the president's not going to sign it. Really, that would be on the president if he wanted to keep hundreds of thousands of public employees without getting any pay.
We have a call coming in from Eva Beach. Stan, you have a question for the senator?
Senator, I'm the son of a sugar, Kauai sugar plantation worker and the most influential person, one of the three, I think, influential persons in my life has been Senator Inouye. Mm-hmm. Actually, in more ways than one, he was significant to me. And I know that he served and was respected. And although he differed strongly, in fact, I actually had positions different from the senator. I expressed it to him that were divergent, and he had that with his colleagues. But he always carried himself with a sense of decorum, with respect and dignity, although he had views that were different. What I'm thinking is the reason that maybe you view most of the Republicans and definitely the president as being evil or, forgive me, but stupid. So maybe that explains your rather coarse language and behavior. And I'm wondering, in the long run, does that represent the state of Hawaii well? And again, I differed with Senator Inouye, and I expressed that to him, but I also expressed to him the fact that he was really significant in the career that I have chosen to make Hawaii better. But just your thoughts about that.
Well, I share that goal of making Hawaii better, and I certainly do not consider my Republican colleagues either stupid or evil. We certainly disagree on a number of really major issues, including, for example, health care. You know, they want to eliminate health care and eliminate protections for people with pre-existing conditions, and that would probably involve a lot of people in Hawaii. So, as I mentioned before, I work with my colleagues with whom I disagree on a number of issues. But, I've introduced bills that have been enacted into law with Deb Fisher of Nebraska, Joni Ernst of Iowa, John Bozeman of Arkansas, Mike Lee of Utah. I even introduced recently a bill that is co-sponsored by Ted Cruz of Texas. So I work with my Republican colleagues on a whole bunch of bills that we proceed in a bipartisan way. So I don't believe that anyone is evil, et cetera, but I certainly raise my voice when I disagree with them. And these are not normal times, so I say that it is really important. It is more important than ever that we speak up. And we have a president, by the way, Stan, who lies every single day. That does not promote the kind of country or Hawaii that we want.
That was Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono when she was in town recently. It was part of a call-in show aired last month. You can listen back to the entire hour on the Conversations page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
You know, it's now time for our reality check, and joining us today is Honolulu Civil Beat's reporter, Christina Jedra. She takes a closer look at the city's approach to fines and how it's how little it's been willing to settle for. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning, Catherine.
So you've come up with some new examples that I wasn't familiar with, because this has been a long-standing criticism of the administration.
That's right. So the Department of Planning and Permitting has for a long time settled with alleged violators for just a percentage of fines. And I thought it was interesting to reexamine it as the city cracks down on short-term vacation rentals, because they'll be imposing fines of thousands of dollars. But it's really likely that those violators will only pay a fraction of their fines, sometimes 10% or less. And ultimately, the city leaves hundreds of thousands of dollars of fine money on the table every year because of this.
And you found a case with a retired Florida attorney running a vacation rental in Kailua.
That's right. This gentleman, Andrew Lippi, who unfortunately I didn't get a chance to talk to, he was running a vacation rental out of Kailua. In 2015, DPP cited him to shut it down. But according to DPP, he continued for over a year. So eventually he racked up $513,000 in fines. Ultimately, he only paid $50,000, or less than 10%, taking advantage of that DPP policy. Doing a little research, I found out that Mr. Lippi is quite wealthy. He just bought an island this year off the Florida Keys for $8 million. And he also owns a mansion resort in Florida that was the set of The Real World on MTV, also a home that he rents out as a short-term vacation rental, funnily enough.
So I imagine the neighbors of this illegal vacation rental were probably livid.
That's right. There was one in particular I talked to who had complained about Lippi to the city for a long time. And he just said, you know, this guy's laughing to the bank. It's the cost of doing business for him to pay $50,000 when he was making money for over a year doing a rental, according to DPP. And so neighbors across the island, see this and feel that people should have to pay up. I spoke with a resident in Pupukea, Denise Antolini, who has opposed a development in her area. That developer, Hanapohaku in Sharks Cove, was cited with $76,000 for alleged illegal grubbing and grading. They only paid about 10%. She just said this is not a deterrent.
And I think that's the frustration. The idea was that this would hopefully be a deterrent, but if there's no enforcement, it just has no teeth.
Right. So that's the argument from neighbors. DPP says actually they feel this is a good system and that it's working. Their argument is that they're about compliance, not punishment, and they really emphasize that they're not a money-making venture. They're not going after people to get every single dollar. And part of the agreement is that the property owner has to fix the violation. So as long as they do that, DPP is willing to kind of accept a much smaller amount of money just to make sure they're in compliance with the law.
I know previous administrations have taken a harder line on this. I remember the former land use and building director, John Whalen. He forced the Palolo Korean Temple to take down part of their tower because they just built too high.
Yeah, each director has a different philosophy, and it's really a system that gives a lot of discretion to the DPP director. So it can kind of go a lot of different ways. Sometimes the rule of thumb has been to settle for 10%. Sometimes it's more than that. Sometimes it's less. The department gives some consideration to folks that might have dementia and have lost control of their property for, you know, mental health reasons or other family circumstances. They have less sympathy for illegal vacation rental owners who are making money.
All right. We'll see what happens with this latest crackdown. Thanks so much, Christina.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Christina Jedra. You can read her report online at civilbeat.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Locations, Haleakala Waldorf School, and Honolulu Waldorf School.
You know, this year we've been fortunate to see new original dance and theater productions of Hawaiian culture and history hit the stage. And this weekend, Language, Olelo Hawaii, is being showcased in a production at the University of Hawaii's Kennedy Auditorium. Tammy Ha'ili Opua Baker is the playwright and director of Aue'ia, The Holding On. Here's a snippet of the original play. The play, which explores time travel, debuts this evening. We invited two of the cast members into our studios who shared that on stage last night, they were overwhelmed as they experienced an emotional moment, and the tears just flowed and flowed. They were feeling the power and the drama behind the written words. We are fortunate this morning to have two guests in studio, Kea Kahikina and Joran Young, two actors in this University of Hawaii production. Good morning.
Aloha.
Good morning.
So tell us about this play and the significance of it.
So this play is entitled Aue'ia, Holding On. Aue'ia means to hold fast or to hold something dear to you. It was a prophecy given for a chief that it was seeing a big overturning of something, a big upheaval of power, a big upheaval of thought process. And so when we think about Aue'ia and it being done in many different vicinities, many different venues now, by different halau, by different groups, it's really a reminder for us as people of this aina to hold on to what is dear, to hold on to culture, to hold on to language, to hold on to our identity. Because if we do not take that kuleana, that responsibility upon ourselves, no one else will. You know, this is a place where it's an original, special culture. And we as theater artists doing this show is doing that, is holding on to how we identify with our history through our own language. So it's really cool to see so many different people from all sorts of walks of life, both students who are in elementary school to our professors at the university, all in one cast. It's really cool to see all of them you know, holding on to all of what they hold dear. So that's kind of like the basis of the show, is telling our story through our language and our perspective.
And this is a special subset in the theater and dance department at
yes.
the University of Hawaii.
So we have the Hana Keaka program is what it's called, Hawaiian Theater. It started in 2015 with its first inaugural production of La Ie Kawai, which is a Hawaiian folklore tale about a beautiful woman of Paliuli on the island of Hawaii. So that was the first production, all in Hawaiian language. And it was like, oh my gosh, like this is really cool to see, because a lot of the material at UH and Kennedy Theater is not really based on any Hawaiian folklore, any Hawaiian language. So it was really a changing point, a pivotal point in trying to get our stories out there. So now Aue'ia is the second production, 2019. Here we are, and hopefully we see a lot more of that as the years go on.
And Joran, you play Princess Ka'iulani?
Correct, this? Yes.
And you were also in another production about the princess as well over at Mamiya Theater.
Yes, A Timeless Princess.
And what I loved about that production was that, you know, it was really pushing the envelope in a lot of ways, but using our history, present day and past. And it was just a wonderful production. So what was it like for you just coming off of that and then working on this show?
Coming straight from that, I was already well aware that there was a lot of history that was being told in both shows. And in that one, it went more into Princess Kaʻiulani's time and then the things that she went through along with the overthrow with a, not overthrow, but the queen being held in her own home as well. So that touched up just a little bit into that historical time. But going into this, I kind of expanded my understanding as to more things that are going on with in O'o'ia. We are focusing on not just the overthrow, but so many different times in our history that we see come alive on stage, and we just get a glimpse of it for each and every scene, and it's so powerful and it's so strong. So going from A Timeless Princess, where, you know, we sing the songs, we have this strong feeling of, like, you know, pride with our princess, with our monarchy, and then going into this where we still have that pride of our monarchy, but then just expanded so much more. And that's what I think is really amazing about these two shows.
And because it really showcases the Hawaiian language too, I mean, that's mm-hmm. really, really something special. And now, did you grow up in the immersion program at all? Because I know there's so many people out there that do, but I don't know, did you have that edge on anybody?
No, not at all. This show has been a very challenging and difficult one for me, because I am very beginner when it comes to Hawaiian language. I wouldn't say that I know the language at all, even at this point, but I have learned so much because of this show. And that's one of the reasons why I took on this show, is because if I'm not challenging myself and pushing myself, then I'm not growing as an actress and as a performer and as a person of learning and studying. And I want to push my studies further, and that's why I took on this show. And I didn't know how much Ōlelo Hawaiʻi I would be speaking, and it turned out to be quite a lot. But I was fortunate enough to be able to learn the language, learn how to speak it, learn how to receive the information, and be able to put that onto a stage where I can feel comfortable in speaking and comfortable with understanding what I am saying and what others are saying to me.
And the main actors, I understand, are doing double duty. So you play two roles in this production.
Actually, all of us, almost everybody in this cast is playing more than just one character. And that's really awesome and exciting to see.
So tell us about the roles that you're playing in this show.
Sure. So there are four haumana, our students, that are the main kind of pillars of the play. As we go through our archive research materials, we get to see different points of history in which Hawaiians and people of the Aina are au'aing, basically, where they're holding on to something that they believe in. I play Kaʻihi. Kaʻihi is, I would say, the 2019 version of Hermione Granger.
Okay.
In that he's very book smart. He's very, it's Wingardium Leviosa, not Wingardium Leviosa, like correcting people on their language. For me, I identify with Kaʻihi because as an actor, we're trying to look at, who are these people growing up? Did they have Hawaiian language experience? Did they have culture experience? I like to believe that Kaʻihi did not, and that's why he's very textbook, is that he didn't have all of that growing up. So looking into these textbooks is now that source for him to feel like, okay, now this is where I can attach, or this is where I can delve into the culture and feel like I'm a part of it. Meanwhile, also looking down on others if they're not well-versed in it. So it's very interesting to see Kaʻihi's standpoint with Ala, who Jordan plays, where we get into a lot of different debates about different things. And so where Kaʻihi feels like there's a lot of power on the masculine side of Hawaiian culture, Jordan, who's the only female of the four, represents the strong female essence of that. So it's really interesting to see how we kind of interweave together and, like,
so you kind of spar.
Right, we spar through the whole thing. And after, like, are you okay? You're good? We're good. Yeah, so it's interesting because it kind of represents that even though Hawaiians are all part of the same lahui, it doesn't necessarily mean we all think the same. It doesn't necessarily mean that because we're all from the same source that we all think like we're always going to get along ever.
And so what has this meant to you being in this production? Because you were in another production that was with the UH Hilo Connect. Is it Todd Farley?
Yes, and Todd Farley's thesis. Tale. Yes, Soldier's Tale, L'Histoire des Soldats, translated to Hawaiian, Mo'olelo Ke Kua. And so it's taking a play, a traditional French play, set now between Hilo and Kona. And that was a mime piece where we had mimes, and then I had Hawaiian language to do my lines. So that was quite an interesting segue from mime into now Aua'ia, because in Mo'olelo Ke Kua, it was really about the physicality and making sure that the audience knew what was going on rather than focusing on text. Whereas Aua'ia is very text heavy, we need to focus on the language so that our audience of both speakers and non-speakers can still understand what's going on. What is the context clues? What are the words that we're trying to hit? And then the other thing too is going back to the double casting is I play Willy Koki and Robert Wilcox. He was a leader of resistance against annexation. And so the really cool thing is seeing when our characters make that shift from going to from the student to that person of history. There is a connection there that we as students aren't aware of until we get onto the stage and we see like, oh my gosh, yeah, we are connected to these people. They're not just people in textbooks that we read about.
That was Akea Kahikina and Jorn Young, both young Native Hawaiian actors, talking about the production Aua'ea, Holding On. It opens tonight and runs through October 6th on the Kennedy Theater main stage. Hey, thanks for joining us. This is Catherine Cruz. Now back over to Pledge Central with Jose Fajardo and Sandy Oshiro.